Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on June 11, 2012, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call. My name is Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome a special guest moderator to our teleforum. Mr. Joel Burkett is a partner at the Sal Ewing Law Firm in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. His principal areas of practice are environmental law, oil and gas law, natural resources law, and environmental litigation. Before entering private practice, he served for 3 years as an assistant attorney general and assistant counsel to the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Resources. He's also a longtime member of the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group Executive Committee, and in that role, he's largely responsible for putting together today's event. Mr. Burkett, the floor is yours.
Drilling for natural gas in unconventional formations is becoming increasingly common. In addition to drilling, the use of hydraulic fracturing has become a key component of such activity. No doubt for the callers on this telephone call today, this is something of great importance and national interest. Such activity has been largely regulated by the states for over 150 years. Increasingly, the federal government has played a role, and there have been many calls for additional federal regulatory involvement. Among the many questions raised is the extent to which the federal government should be involved in the regulation of drilling and fracking. In testimony just 2 weeks ago to the United States House of Representatives Committee on Oversight and Governmental Reform, Michael Crancer, the Secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, stated as follows, and stated something that I think helps to define our discussion today. Secretary Crancer stated, "There is no question that states can do and are doing a better job regulating the oil and gas extraction technique of hydraulic fracturing within their borders than the federal government could do. No one-size-fits-all is applicable in this field. Each state is different and has different geography, topography, geology, hydrogeology, and meteorology. In fact, the states in which hydraulic fracturing has and is taking place have been regulating that activity for many years already. The states are light years ahead of the federal government in terms of experience and know-how about their individual states and about the science and technique of hydraulic fracturing." Secretary Crancer's comments were viewed as being controversial, and he was challenged by some of the congressmen on that committee. Our speakers today represent a variety of positions. We have speakers from industry, the environmental groups, as well as the states. Our speakers today are Jason Hutt, Scott Perry, and Craig Siegel. To introduce them, let me give you a brief summary of their biography in the alphabetical order. Jason Hutt is a partner with Bracewell & Giuliani in Washington, D.C. He advises energy companies, manufacturers, project developers, investor groups, and financial institutions about environmental risks and liabilities associated with regulatory compliance, project development, congressional investigations, internal investigations, and corporate transactions. He also assists the defense of administrative, civil, and criminal proceedings involving environmental enforcement agencies at the federal and state levels. Mr. Hutt counsels clients on current and upcoming regulatory developments at the nexus of environmental and energy policy with focused attention on natural gas development, including hydraulic fracturing, responses to the Deepwater Horizon incident, and climate change. He is nationally recognized for his work on shale gas issues on behalf of producers, oil field service companies, hedge funds, and technology developers. Mr. Hutt is a graduate of Colgate University and Vermont Law School. Scott Perry is the Deputy Secretary in the Department of Environmental Protection's newly created Office of Oil and Gas Management. Prior to becoming Deputy Secretary, Scott was the Director of the Bureau of Oil and Gas Management for almost 2 years. Scott was also an assistant counsel with the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection's Bureau of Regulatory Counsel. He earned his bachelor's from Penn State University and his JD from Willamette University College of Law in Salem, Oregon. Our third speaker is Craig Siegel. Craig is an associate attorney with the Sierra Club Environmental Law Program. Craig started with the Sierra Club in 2008 as an environmental law fellow. Before coming to the club, Craig was a law clerk to the Honorable Marsha Burzin of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. He is a graduate of the University of Chicago and Stanford Law School, where he says he spent most of his time in the basement working with Stanford's Environmental Law Clinic. We have the unique opportunity today from hearing all three of these speakers and also hearing your questions. Your questions are going to be very important to us, and I think I will facilitate a very exciting exchange between our speakers. I'm going to start out with brief statements from each of the speakers and presenting what I believe will be the position that there ought to be more federal involvement. We're going to begin with Craig Siegel. Craig?
Yes, thank you. So I'm going to begin as the person leading off by indulging a little more background than I would otherwise do, but I'll move quickly. I think our question today, at least as I view it, is whether or not oil and gas drilling should be covered under the same cooperative federalism framework as essentially all other industrial activities. So I'm going to talk about that in the affirmative, and I'm going to hit 3 points. I'm going to talk about the cooperative federalism framework that generally underlies federal environmental law. I'm going to talk about the range of impacts that need management from oil and gas drilling. And I'm going to highlight what I view, at least, as the minimal interventions we have thus far seen from the federal government. To begin, as many of our listeners will be familiar, most modern environmental law, including the Clean Air, Clean Water, and Safe Drinking Water Acts, is premised, in fact, on notions not unlike those Michael Krantzer forwarded at the hearings a few weeks ago, that states, as the on-the-ground regulators, tend to do best at modifying general standards for local conditions and for understanding the needs of their particular regulated parties. However, federal law is also motivated by concerns to which the federal government is uniquely responsive, including normalizing complex regulatory standards across states, both to avoid patchwork environmental regulations that could otherwise create compliance problems, and to avoid problems of agency capture by either industrial or environmental interests at the state level, and by ensuring some commonly shared baselines for pollution that can cross state boundaries. Thus, the AIR Act, for instance, sets national air quality standards and charges states with meeting them, and sets national permitting programs, most of which are delegated to the states with some degree of EPA oversight. This general structure is one that's been used throughout the federal environmental infrastructure and is, I think, responsible for a significant amount of the progress we've made in the last 40 years on reducing most forms of air and water pollution. The oil and gas industry, however, has procured for itself unusual exemptions from these rules. Under both the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts, it enjoys various exemptions as to the aggregation of pollution sources and sediment runoff from its operations. Under the Safe Drinking Water Act, perhaps most famously, large portions of its operations are simply not regulable as a federal matter, save for those involving diesel fuel and certain emergency situations. And under the Waste Acts, including Superfund, significant portions of oil and gas waste are not regulable as the hazardous waste that their constituents would otherwise be. The policy wisdom of these exemptions, I think, has opened a significant question given the lobbying strength of the industry and its considerable efforts and considerable links with pollution problems. Now, that said, some of these exemptions are statutory, some regulatory. And I think we're talking today both about what should be and what can immediately be accomplished. And the truth of the matter is, on the regulatory grounding, EPA and the feds can do a significant amount of work to address impacts even now. In other areas, Congress would have to act directly to remove these exemptions. So that's where we stand. The question is whether or not this fairly unusual regulatory framework under which states have more authority and fewer and less federal support than most other areas should persist, if there's something unique about this industry that warrants it. Now, moving to point two, my contention is no. And if anything, what's unique about the industry argues the other way. Oil and gas is, of course, a highly local endeavor by some measures. You're dealing with particular formations, particular strata, and particular waste problems here and there. But this is not a unique problem under federal environmental law. It's common to any industry. You'll have the particular characteristics of a plant, a facility, or installation. And it's also a rapidly expanding field. The president's charged a large and impartial body of experts through the DOE's Shale Gas Subcommittee to assess its risks, and they conclude those risks were significant and warranting enhanced regulatory oversight, in large part because many of the federal standards that do apply are now decades old, and many states confronting the boom are either confronting it anew or confronting a significantly increased intensity of development. These impacts include substantial air emissions, both of greenhouse gases like methane and of conventional pollutants like volatile organic compounds and of hazardous air pollutants like benzene, which have been directly measured near fields in Colorado, especially to be above levels anticipated by EPA and above levels that would imperil human health. They include real concerns about water quality. The focus, of course, of a lot of activist concern has been directly on fracturing, the actual moment of fracture in subsurface contaminating water. Although we think that's a real risk in some circumstances, there are also, in some ways, less sexy but more common risks associated with just plain old poor well construction, sediment runoff on the surface, and leaks from pits and waste disposal sites. Also, in the water quality camp, are real concerns about how to effectively manage large volumes of highly salty and often otherwise contaminated wastewater from these well sites, which public sewage treatment plants are very poorly equipped to handle, and which confront real shortages in injection well capacity. And then finally, there are larger questions, generally more devoted to local and state level, around land use and disruption associated with the construction of thousands of wells, often in existing residential and rural areas. So we're looking at real impacts. They are not trivial. They're widespread, and as tens of thousands of wells are constructed in the next few years, they warrant careful attention both to protect the public and, frankly, to protect the industry. We've seen a real groundswell of opposition, not just to unsafe drilling, but to drilling altogether. That, I think, is largely attributable to initial, quite poorly regulated, and extremely quick development of areas that hadn't previously confronted it, combined with some dismissive industry attitudes who insisted that anyone complaining about a well in their backyard was probably a fearmonger rather than a legitimately concerned property owner. And the final point I'll make in this opening set of remarks is the rather minimal nature of federal interventions thus far. There are three major rulemakings going on right now, or recently completed. The first is a set of federal air quality standards, largely focused on reducing emissions from wells and production equipment of hazardous air pollutants and volatile organic compounds, which form smog. Those rules are modeled very closely on rules already in force in Colorado and Wyoming, but which don't apply uniformly across the country. They will be phased in over the next 2.5 years and mostly require direct capture of emissions that would otherwise have been vented, quite often to the economic benefit of the regulated industry, which would otherwise not be able to resell those emissions. Second, EPA has promulgated a draft guidance using its remaining authority under the Safe Drinking Water Act to promote basic federal standards in areas where the feds regulate injection well programs for wells using diesel fuels. Diesel contains a great deal, in some cases, of benzene and other significantly hazardous organic compounds. These standards urge permit writers to make sure that wells have the integrity needed to prevent these from leaking and that wastes are well managed. States are invited and encouraged to use these standards in their own permitting, but are not required to do so. And finally, the BLM, which is the only regulator in many instances of federal minerals, has promulgated basic disclosure, waste management, and well integrity regulations for drilling on federal land, including on federal mineral rights that underlie private land, which is a significant problem, especially in the West. So that's really what we're talking about here. I think we're seeing the extension of baseline federal standards addressing those areas in which the federal government retains authority, and a great deal of state regulation on top of that. I don't think we're facing a substantial regulatory crisis or a real roadblock. The International Energy Agency came out with a report last week saying that all these changes, if implemented universally, would only add about 7% to the cost of production total. And I think we're seeing, to the extent that the government can do, given the exemptions the industry has procured, the use of its usual regulatory role as universal backstop and baseline standard setter above which states are free to regulate. So, Joel, that's my take.
All right. Thank you very much, Craig. Our next speaker is Jason Hutt, who will present some introductory remarks.
Thanks, Joel. This is Jason Hutt. I think just I would like to add to some of the things that Craig said and maybe provide a different perspective on a couple of them. He talked a little bit about sort of the unique geology and resources that the argument is don't lend themselves to necessarily a one-size-fits-all approach. And he did a nice job of laying out some of the challenges associated with industry, but didn't really delve into what those solutions are. And the solutions end up being not uniform in many, many respects. So when you have a federalism framework, such as the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act, and then you look at an industry where if you're a refiner or a coal-fired power plant, and the way in which you produce your product, either a cracked hydrocarbon or electricity from coal, in those instances, the methodologies that are used are very much the same. The challenges that present themselves are very much the same. And the solutions are very much the same because you're talking about pollution control equipment and best practices. When you get into an industry like the oil and gas industry, and you're taking minerals out of the ground, you find yourself facing challenges related to water supply, land use, roads, localized issues, and the solutions end up being very not so much less uniform than in those other industries. And so I think that's one of the reasons that while they're characterized, Craig characterized them as exemptions, really the two have evolved separately. If you go back and look at oil and gas regulation over time in the different states, they evolved separately because they involved different types of challenges and different types of solutions. So that's one thing to keep in mind. Another is also the pace at which the industry has changed, particularly over the last decade. So when you look at the refining industry or the coal-fired power industry, just as examples to place into that federalism framework, you're talking about industries where really the method of production hasn't changed over almost a century. There are different methods for controlling pollution at the end of those, at the end of the smokestacks or the pipes, whatever the discharge is. But when you look at the last decade of shale gas development and hydraulic fracturing, it's very important to keep in mind that the methodologies and the techniques that are being used in the industry are changing really on an exponential curve. And really what that begs for is people on the ground at the local level in dialogue with the industry, understanding what the impacts to the resources are and may be, so that best practices can stay apace of what's happening at the local level. And that's really how it has been borne out in large part, and I suspect that Scott Perry will address some of that at the Pennsylvania level, which really has some of the state-of-the-art oil and gas regulations out there for working with the oil and gas industry to safely and in an environmentally sensitive way extract the resources. Craig talked a little bit about the role that the federal government has had over time with respect to the oil and gas industry. He talked about the air quality standards that are modeled after Colorado and Wyoming. I think those have been largely welcomed by the industry. I know there's a comment period coming here. But those have been accepted, and that's where you're talking about a resource that's a much more ubiquitous resource that affects people across state lines and really calls for a greater role for the federal government. He talked about the EPA draft diesel guidance. I think there's a but there, and the but is bearing in mind that many states have primacy in their permitting program for the implementation of permits under the Underground Injection Control Program. And as a result, the document will have a significant impact on how states are able to regulate oil and gas extraction, not just with the use of diesel, because really the draft diesel guidance sets up a set of expectations with respect to well integrity. And I think that they will be used as a model regardless of whether diesel is being used in a well that's being fracked. And so that's really where the EPA has sort of used its existing authority to kind of slide the wedge in to the state effort to regulate oil and gas. On the BLM side, the proposed rule that's out that covers disclosure, waste management, and well integrity, as Craig outlined, is an important rule for having a set of standards with respect to federal lands. The but being that there's also an impact on revenue for states, a very significant impact, remembering that many states, particularly the western states, rely significantly on the income stream that comes from oil and gas development on federal lands within the boundaries of those states. They share in those royalty payments. And if these rules are promulgated in a way that's too onerous or that doesn't provide sufficient predictability for oil and gas operators such that they are willing to pay less for those leases versus leases on private lands, then the states will see an impact on the revenue side. And the second is, again, with respect to well integrity requirements, the BLM proposed rule lays those out, and I think that you will see pressure being brought by EPA and Department of Interior to see those rules adopted at the state levels. A fourth way in which the federal government has played a very significant role in the oil and gas industry is through the enforcement arm of EPA, known as OECA, the Office of Enforcement and Compliance Assurance. It is viewed as through settlements. EPA has developed legal theories under existing law through which they push industry to come into a settlement agreement with the agency. It's a bilateral contract in which the industry finds themselves making commitments not just to pay penalties, but also in the form of injunctive relief. And those forms of injunctive relief then begin to set the standard within the industry as to what practices, pollution control equipment, and other changes are expected by the agency. And OECA, the EPA's OECA office, has announced an enforcement initiative, a priority to bring enforcement against the energy extraction industry. They have been exercising that authority with some frequency. They expect to do it between 2011 and 2013, and that's a significant area to continue to keep an eye on as the agency sort of flexes its muscle in that direction and really, in many ways, does a job that a lot of the states were already doing. I think Scott can probably address some of the enforcement activities within the Pennsylvania DEP and his office as well. So that's sort of a framework. I think that just overall in addressing Joel's question, you know, there is a role for the federal government with respect to on the air quality side. There's much less of a role under the other statutes because of what a great job the states are doing and their ability to stay apace of the changes that are happening in the industry.
Jason, thank you very much for your introductory remarks. We'll now turn it over to Scott Perry. Scott?
Thanks, Joel. And there's so much that Craig and Jason have covered. I'm going to try and not be duplicative, but I do want to recognize the large and important role that EPA does play in oil and gas development activities. Jason and Craig highlighted them, the air quality issues, as well as wastewater management, two issues of great importance to Pennsylvania, and matters that have a direct effect on public health as well as the environment. So to categorize EPA's role in the oil and gas industry as small would be a mistake. But they do not play a role in just the actual well permitting and well drilling activities. Other than that, we noted an exemption under the hazardous waste rules for the waste, but EPA has used their CERCLA authority to investigate and take enforcement actions at well sites where wastes have been spilled. So EPA clearly playing a large role. And historically, with environmental rules, it really does go without saying, in my opinion, that the federal law has clearly brought about substantial environmental improvements. However, this is not 1970 anymore, and the states clearly have superior history with regulating oil and gas activities. And I do believe that the variances from jurisdiction to jurisdiction warrant that continued role between EPA and the states. So when I think about whether EPA needs to play a larger role in the state's management of oil and gas activities, I think of a couple of things, and focusing on what is the benefit to be gained. And I think in the past we've seen benefits where you have a need for a nationwide standard, and I think FIFRA provides a great example of this, where you have a uniform standard for labeling the various insecticides or rodenticides. If it was left to the states to manage these kind of warning labels, of course you'd have these packages with conceivably 50 different labels on it, greatly retarding the ability of an industry to operate across state boundaries. Another area where I think federal involvement has provided benefits for public health and environmental protection is where you have these interstate impacts. And that's really prevalent with air pollution control, as well as wastewater discharges, where air and water don't know state geographic boundaries, and what activities occur in one state has a direct effect on the health and welfare of neighboring states. The final area where I think that federal intervention has been appropriate is quite simply where states have failed to address a problem. When I take a look at, then I think that would be a case in just solid waste management, where historic waste management practices in Pennsylvania did not meet the kinds of modern day landfill standards we see here in the Commonwealth. So when I look at those three things, the need for uniformity, the transboundary impacts, and then maybe a failure of state to act, I just don't see where additional federal involvement solves any of these problems. And in fact, trying to impose some kind of uniform standard, I think would create significant challenges. The rules would either need to be so incredibly prescriptive by geographic area that they would be almost unworkable, or they would be so general as to be to really be subject to a broad range of various interpretations. And I just want to highlight a couple of examples where I do believe that changes in topography, climatology, geology actually matter. So Pennsylvania has a very robust erosion and sediment control program that's modeled after the stormwater NPDES permit program that we have in the state. Is that same level of permitting and control appropriate in very arid climates like Texas or New Mexico, or areas like Oklahoma or Kansas that don't have the same kinds of geography that Pennsylvania has? I think that states are better suited to address those kinds of erosion and sediment control matters best within their own territories. That kind of uniform standard for the oil and gas activity does not make a lot of sense. Another area where I think it's important to recognize differences is, quite frankly, in groundwater protection. Under the EPA's Underground Injection Control Program, they define freshwater as water containing less than 10,000 milligrams per liter of total dissolved solids. And some of the arid states have followed that rule. Now, in Pennsylvania, what that means for well construction is that you would set your surface casing all the way through water zones that have less than 10,000 milligrams per liter. Now, I think it pretty much goes without saying that in water-rich states like Pennsylvania, that would actually have a disastrous consequence, where you'd have this commingling of shallow brines with fresh groundwater. Water used in Pennsylvania is typically far less than 10,000 milligrams per liter. And so setting that deep surface string could actually cause an environmental problem. So you need to have flexibility from location to location and how you construct your well to address the various sources of fresh groundwater that are used. And of course, geology is important. Even in Pennsylvania, you have different rules depending on where you're at. So if you're drilling through workable coal seams, you have to have your well spacing set differently than where you're not drilling through a coal. If you're drilling through salt formations, you have to have additional strings of casing that protect the well from being collapsed because of the plastic nature of the salt. So, and also, of course, Pennsylvania has a lot of shallow gas producing zones that when I speak to other folks out in North Dakota or Oklahoma, they just don't have. So you design your well and your cement slurries differently to address that. So if the federal government was to step in and try and develop a one-size-fits-all regulatory approach to deal with all of these various situations with respect to well construction, the regulations would probably look like something like the Encyclopedia Britannica, or they'd be so generalized as to provide very little guidance as to the regulator or the industry and the public as to what the actual standard is going to be. And the last thing I think I need to discuss here is the importance of being responsive and responsible regulator. Now, obviously, oil and gas development activities do have the potential to affect public safety, public health, and the environment. but it's also an industry that's producing products that form the basis of modern society. So recognizing that it's a product that we all rely on in our daily lives, it's important that that our rules be tailored to promote the economic development of the resource while at the same time being very protective of the environment. Regulating just to regulate is not going to do anybody any good, in my opinion. And ultimately, the states have crafted the rules that that are necessary to manage the potential impacts of this industry. And we've done so in partnership with EPA where appropriate. So that's my take on that. I look forward to answering questions.
Scott, thank you very much. I appreciate your comments. Let me ask this question as a starting point. And we'll start out with Pennsylvania, but I'd be interested in the views of all of our speakers on this. And that is the question of whether or not the states have the resources to properly regulate hydraulic fracturing. Scott,
well, Joel,
why don't we start with you?
Sure, Joel. Yeah, this is Scott Perry. And the answer is unequivocally yes. Far greater resources than the federal government, in fact. When you think about state by state, the number of people that are involved in managing oil and gas activities just dwarfs the number of federal employees. We've expanded our staffing from over 80 people in 2007 to now 202 folks that are directly regulating this industry in Pennsylvania. And we have the ability to address any kind of additional staffing needs through the well permit fee. So I know that the states are indeed best suited to manage those on the ground issues far better than the Environmental Protection Agency. And if EPA is involved, they would not be so much involved in the daily inspections anyway. When you have a primacy agreement with EPA, by and large, they're managing you from afar, not being in the field on the ground inspecting these facilities. So the states have staffed up to address the expanded oil and gas activities in their jurisdictions, and particularly in Pennsylvania, we have more folks working in the program now than ever before.
And Jason, what's your experience been in other states other than Pennsylvania?
Well, I think the same thing is true in most other states where, you know, the policy of the user pays has really prevailed, such that if states found themselves with insufficient resources, they would increase permitting fees. And I think industry, to the extent that they can get a certainty as to the timing and outcome of a regulatory process, is willing to pay those reasonable fees so that they can keep that process moving. It's very important to the industry not to have idle time with their equipment. And so they really look to the regulators on the ground to provide a certainty on the timing and the outcome of that process so that they have predictability. Another thing I would say in answer to your question is regulate can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. So if it means processing permits and looking at, you know, on-the-ground specific issues, that really is a role for the states, and they have the resources to do that. There is a role for EPA, however, in sort of the broader definition of regulate, and that is to help states in understanding the processes and sharing best practices that are observed in other states and sharing lessons learned and setting up those types of forums to facilitate that type of educational process. There certainly is a role there so that lessons can be learned and derived from other places and brought to bear in other states.
Greg, what's your position on whether or not the states have the resources to regulate hydraulic fracturing?
Well, Jason's last point is a good one. There are significant differences between, you know, deep research capacity and resource sharing, and overall oversight, which is where EPA really lives, and on-the-ground day-to-day inspection. As to the latter, that has always been and always will be a primarily state role since, you know, they live there. And there it varies. Their states are certainly staffing up in response to the boom. Some states have been able to do that more successfully than others and raise fees more or less quickly to be commensurate with their real needs. In our experience, there are still significant shortages in some states in inspections and in oversight, but certainly the intention of those states to move forward. But it can take time, especially the time when budgets are falling, despite, in most cases, of regulations that try to provide parity between permit fees and staffing resources. But I don't want to undersell that as a real staffing and regulatory challenge that's being met with various success in various states. The larger point, though, is this is not an uncommon situation where EPA is providing the backbone role, is intervening in particularly serious enforcement actions of national interest and importance, and where the states are taking the primary lead on day-to-day permitting and enforcement.
Thank you very much. Scott, another question for you. Maybe you could enlighten our audience on how EPA came to be involved in DMIC and what's going to happen next.
Sure. The discussions between EPA and the department concerning DMIC had actually begun months and months before they actually intervened and provided temporary water. The concern initially from EPA was the department's decision to allow Cabot to discontinue providing temporary water to the residents. And we made that decision based on the consent order and agreement we had entered into with Cabot, where they had established an escrow account with some $4.2 million in it for the use by the homeowners to address their water supply needs in the manner that they best saw fit. And it also stood ready to provide the homeowners with a methane treatment system to remove the methane from their drinking water, which was the problem there. Because they met those two conditions, they had met the terms of the consent order and were able to discontinue providing temporary water. And that's when I think some of the discussions between Pennsylvania and EPA began to escalate. At about the same time, EPA was provided with some sample results that they had obtained from the litigants, that the Cabot Oil and Gas had done some testing in the DMIC area, and they noted some synthetic organic compounds were being detected in some of these sample results. Now, it was not, as EPA noted in their own memoranda, the data was of very questionable quality because there was, they had no, they didn't have any of the background QAQC sheets associated with the samples, and they weren't even really clear where the sample results came from. So, but nonetheless, they noted that some of these synthetic organic compounds were detected. They also had data from the department that showed that at some time historically, pretty much right around the time that we took our first enforcement action, some parameters like iron, manganese, aluminum, and arsenic in one case were elevated. Now those parameters at the time they were going to take their action were not elevated, but at the in historically. There were some high hits. Unfortunately, in two of the situations, it actually turned out to be lab error. But based on some data that was a year or 2 years old, and this questionable data that was provided to them by the litigants, it was EPA's decision to go and provide temporary water immediately. We were in the process of working out a sampling plan with them, but they felt it was prudent to go and provide water first, and then test the water supplies later. So I, at the time, was pretty confident that the water was clean because we had actually gone out previously and tested some 30 homes, not just the litigants' homes, for all the parameters under the safe drinking water list, and it determined that, yes, in fact, aside from methane and aside from some elevated levels of secondary contaminants like iron and manganese, that the water was, in fact, safe and DMIC. And the test results that we ended up conducting alongside EPA and Cabot have proved that out again, so that the water is indeed safe to drink in DMIC, but methane migration continues to be a problem, and that some of the other tangential issues associated with the methane migration problem, notably higher levels of exceedances of secondary drinking water standards for iron and manganese, do persist in a small number of the wells that are there. So at the moment, it appears that the sampling results have concluded. I believe EPA may be intending to go back in and do one or two more rounds of testing, but the department is not going to be participating in that that second effort. So I believe that the temporary water is going to be discontinued, and the matter will conclude.
Thank you. Are there any other comments from the speakers regarding DMIC?
I would just add, Joel and Scott really laid it out nicely, that this is Jason. There are not drinking water well standards for construction in Pennsylvania. There hadn't been when these wells were constructed. And so a lot of the methane migration and potential issues related to the migration of contaminants from around the well, either at the surface or below ground, really have a lot to do with how the well was constructed. And there are numerous sources very proximate to the wells of these litigants whose lawyers are fueling a lot of the attention that's coming to Dimock. And it's sort of a shame because it's not allowing the real discussion about oil and gas extraction to really sort of play out. And it's sort of histrionics and a lot of hysteria where there's just a limited number of people who have sort of undertaken this banner. But the potential sources for contaminants range from sort of the goats and animals that walk around the surface of this well area to the street that's just above it in a couple of instances. So it's one thing to talk about the well and EPA's concern about water quality in the well and the providing of water to the litigants after Pennsylvania had sort of deemed it to be sufficiently safe to move forward. But it's another thing to suggest that there was any sort of linkage between anything that might have been found in those wells and the activities of the oil and gas industry, which are several hundred feet, thousands of feet away from these wells, and when there are sources that are much closer.
Thank you, Jason. Any other comments?
I'll add only that methane migration is a real challenge, and that the efforts in Dimock, both to get good initial baseline data and then to go through testing, I think help highlight that and the need for reasonable casing standards throughout. There's a lot of attention to deep well fracturing, but I think among the more common contamination vectors or potential contamination vectors is just plain poor casing jobs. It's deeply unglamorous, but also quite important. And one of the, I think, both important with state and federal initiatives in recent years has been trying to develop a reasonable casing programs for various geologies. One note I'll make in response to an earlier comment that I think Scott made is, EPA's diesel guidance, for instance, I think recognizes the challenge of dealing with different geologies with a common set of tools and focuses pretty strongly on questions for permit writers, helping them figure out how to analyze the area of review and think through what your various casing and cementing requirements should be given the area you're looking at. So one of the pieces I think that will be important for both federal and state regulators to do in the next few years is to work out what is the right analytic path to develop both state level and federal regulations for these pieces and to look seriously at a permitting and monitoring regime that can catch these problems efficiently.
Craig, it was widely reported in the Wall Street Journal about 2 weeks ago that the executive director of the Sierra Club, Michael Byrne, said, and I quote, "We're going to be preventing new gas plants from being built wherever we can. The less natural gas we burn, the better off we will be." That day, there was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal that opined, quote, "The goal is to shut the industry down, not merely to impose higher safety standards." The question that I have is that by embracing federal regulation, is the Sierra Club looking for uniform regulation, or is it seeking a way to shut down industry via one-stop shopping with the EPA administrator?
The answer is the former. We are trying very hard, recognizing, I think, as we have to, that there'll be significant gas extraction for the foreseeable future to make it as safe as possible. There's a separate energy policy challenge, which let me talk about briefly, although I don't think it's the core subject of this call. According to the International Energy Agency and all credible climate modelers that I've run into, even assuming that upstream gas methane is not a large problem, although we think it's a substantial concern, simply switching from coal to gas does not get us where we need to be for a safe climate. IEA suggests we get to about 3.5 degrees C of warming if gas replaces about 4% of coal's market share. You end up cutting carbon, in other words, but you don't cut it enough to get to safe atmospheric concentrations. So our larger energy policy goal is, as coal plants retire over the next few years, to ensure that the maximum number of them are replaced with energy efficiency and renewable rather than gas. And in a lot of cases, it's quite possible. California, for instance, has been holding its per capita energy use steady since the 1970s, in large part through energy efficiency programs. In a lot of the rest of the country, those programs haven't been in place, and as a result, you have a huge amount of untapped demand-side management opportunities, most of which we think are sufficient to take up a lot of the slack from coal plants retiring in the next few years. We'd much rather see people going that route. It's cheaper. It employs people locally to do retrofits and to work on industrial energy efficiency than building new fossil fuel plants, because that doesn't put us on a safe climate path.
Thanks, Craig. I understand we do have a call now from the audience.
We do, Joel. Let's go to that first question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. A little disappointed that others are not asking questions, but let me offer mine about constitutional issues. Can any of the participants, using no court precedents since 1787, but only sources of the usages of terms in the Constitution from before 1787, provide any authority in the Constitution for the regulation of extraction?
Well, I'm not sure why you wouldn't cite 200 years of law to discuss, you know, the regulatory regime. But I would say that Congress's general powers under commerce, welfare, and taxing provide more than sufficient authority for environmental statutes, and that the court has repeatedly upheld them.
Well, there's also, this is Jason, there's obviously a statute that authorizes work through Congress's legislative authority, has authorized the Department of Interior to harvest the resources of the United States for the benefit of the people of the United States. So that comes through its authority to enact legislation in the Constitution, and you know, that's why the Department of Interior was created.
Well, that would be his own resources, but what about other people's?
So again, well, I guess the Environmental Protection Agency was a creation of the administration through their authority to create administrations for the protection of the environment for the people. That's, I guess, would be the constitutional derivation of that.
But the environment is not federal property.
No, these are issues of commerce and general welfare, I think. You're dealing with and significant questions about the protection of private property. You know, there's a common law tradition dating back well before the Constitution, in which the Constitution, you know, I think, embraces and protects under the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, of a law of nuisance. That's been largely translated into statutory form, although not entirely, through the major enactments of the 60s and 70s that created most of our modern constitutional framework, our environmental framework, and it moves forward from there.
And certainly when you go back prior to the 1970s, the principal mechanism for protecting the environment would have been the common law mechanisms of public nuisance and trespass and other mechanisms along those lines. Those have been common law theories that would have been in existence for quite a long time. While they're not directly espoused in the United States Constitution, certainly the Constitution did not overturn or disrupt common law in the United States.
That would allow for litigation, but what about regulation, the intervention of government?
Well, again, that's commerce power, taxing power, general welfare. And I guess I'd just say, you know, beyond a purely theoretical debate, litigation by individual property owners is a notably bad way to handle state-level problems and national-level problems of this sort. If you're trying to manage thousands of wells, all of which need to be cased, and properly regulated, and systems often stretch hundreds of miles of pipeline, you really don't want to rely on individual private litigants to set your entire industry strategy. It's notably bad news for industry. It's bad news for private litigants, and it would be really inefficient.
All right. We do have another question now, and so, Dean, I'll turn it over to you for the next question.
Very good. Let's go to that next caller.
Hi, this is Tom Getty. I had a question for any of the panelists. One of the arguments in support of increased federal involvement is the potential of the plethora of state laws, as it's written up on our webpage. And I just want to ask, to what extent are state laws inconsistent or problematic in their multitude that would justify additional support for federal involvement?
So let me take a stab at that. This varies substantially by area of media, in other words, what sort of pollutant you're dealing with. I think you'd have real challenges with notably variable pollution laws, both because you're trying to run systems and drilling strategies across states and because air emissions move across boundaries. I think there are similar arguments to be made about waste disposal and waste handling regulations because waste also moves across boundaries, both as discharged and in shipments. For instance, a lot of Pennsylvania's Marcellus well waste seems to be going to Ohio injection wells, or at least there's a lot of interest there. So I think there is interest in trying to get those regional problems right. There are less direct areas where you have, you know, you're drilling in one state, so it's not as if your well is being regulated by different state regulators. It's more about how do you manage regional frameworks, in my view at least, according to some sort of common standard where one state can impact another state. Scott, I don't know if you've got a different take on that.
Well, I'll take a bit of an ironic take on it, which is that Pennsylvania is currently being directly impacted by other states' regulatory desires, and that is within the Delaware River Basin. There's no opportunity for well drilling to take place because of the lack of action by our sister states. So, in a strange way, a uniform process would have enabled some of the folks that have land in the Delaware Basin to take advantage of that mineral property and have well drilling occur there. But the drillers, the ones that would complain the most about inconsistent rules are the drillers. And of course, they firmly believe that state by state regulation of well construction, at least, is the way to go. So while there, I think that you will definitely see differences in processes, the general regulatory goals are very much the same.
All right, we have some more questions. Dean?
Yes, Joe, we have, it looks like, at least two more questions at this point, so we can go to the next one.
Hello, it's Chris Wright, and you guys have talked a little bit about cement casing problems for isolation from downhole, and which I entirely agree with. That's really an oil and gas drilling thing, whether you frack or not. It's not really related to fracking. So I've heard a lot of chatter these days about fracks, and they're going to grow up and hit groundwater, and that itself presents a risk, the process of fracturing. So I'd love to hear from Craig whether there's still a concern about that, or is the focus entirely shifted to well construction and surface activities?
So there is still a concern, but it's a much less well-documented and well-studied area. You'll hear from industry folks that it's just implausible because the moment of fracture occurs so deep. This isn't actually uniformly true. In some formations, coal bed methane is the obvious, you're fracturing very close to the surface. In others, you have natural faults or other pathways to the surface. The ongoing debate over just what happened in Pavilion, Wyoming is an instance where we may be seeing migration upward from fractures in addition to downward contamination from casing or pits. Depends, I think, really sensitively on local geology, what you're injecting, which is one really good argument for trying to get as much diesel as you can out of the fuels, and better monitoring. Generally, of course, you know, when you're fracturing, you're doing your best to track where the fractures go, but you may or may not have a great sense of all the pathways of communication to the surface. There's a congressionally mandated, EPA-funded effort going on now to try to track this down in a bit more detail, looking both at theory and at case studies across the country, and I think that will be really useful to get a better sense of when we're looking at real risk factors that we need to manage and when we aren't.
Does anybody else want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, Joel.
Go ahead.
This is Jason. I would modify your question a little bit. So there's three stages to the development of a well. There's drilling the well, there's completing the well, which is when hydraulic fracturing occurs, and then there's producing the well. And the setting of the casing is going to occur during that completion phase where they're setting that cement casing. And the reason that hydraulic fracturing brings a different dynamic other than simple sort of oil and gas, a simple oil and gas well, would be that when you exert the pressures on the pipe going down to fracture the formation, you know, a mile, 2 miles below the earth, that pipe actually expands, even though it's a steel casing, that pipe expands and then it contracts each time that you frack a different stage of the well. And so what that has the potential to do is to change the bond that exists between the cement on the outside of that pipe and the pipe itself, depending upon the compressibility of that cement and other different characteristics of that cement, you can create what's called a microannulus behind the pipe. So it is its own set of unique challenges that states are wrestling with and that EPA is looking at in their study and that the industry is getting better and better at understanding the integrity of that cement, whether or not you've created a uniform sheath behind the pipe, and then whether that sheath has been maintained through the fracking process.
Yeah, Joel, this is Scott Perry. What I would just add is it's unfortunate, though, that the term fracking is now applied to all aspects of well drilling, everything from pad development to wastewater disposal. So I think it's the reason it's unfortunate now is that you can't properly segregate out the various issues that are legitimate and really do need to be looked at. Well, construction and methane migration is, of course, our top priority. It has a direct effect on public safety, but people confuse what happened in Dimmick with a fracking problem when that just is not the case. So from Pennsylvania's standpoint, fracking is not the issue. It's well construction and it's proper management of product and waste at the surface.
Thank you, Scott. I think we have another question waiting. Dean?
We do. We're just about out of time, but we have, it looks like, a final question. We can go to that question.
Good afternoon, folks. This is Andy Yurko in Los Angeles. I'm a Pennsylvania native, born and raised in this state, and graduate of Penn State and its law school. And I'm also involved in gas production in Pennsylvania. We currently have about 60,000 acres under lease. One of the things I'd like to mention is that several years ago, our university set up a group to look into fracking and other methods of obtaining gas without destroying the environment. And the group has been supported by the state and also by the industry, of which my company is very actively involved. And it seems everybody's talking about regulation, and I don't see very much coming out other than from what's coming out of this group about solutions to any of the problems, groundwater problems, for example, and wastewater. And it's kind of frustrating from the industry standpoint, where we see everybody trying to regulate and nobody really trying to help the industry. Where Governor Corbett and before him Governor Rendell have been very active because they wanted the industry to develop in the state of Pennsylvania. And I don't know, it just seems to have slowed down now. Kind of a lethargy has set in, and it's concerning to the industry and to the regulators tripping over each other and nobody trying to solve the problem.
Scott, do you want to hazard a quick answer? We only have another minute or so.
Well, you know, part of the answers to the problems also, I think, are on the industry side. Dealing with wastewater in particular is one where new technologies need to be brought on board and deployed more widely, so that you can manage wastewater in a way other than discharging into streams and rivers. That's just a process that has proven itself to be just harmful. So we've seen tremendous innovation, I believe, in just the past couple of years that have radically increased the well drilling efficiency and then, of course, management of waste so that there can be beneficial reuse of them. So I think part of that's been driven by regulation, that if there was no call to cease taking wastewater to facilities that can't properly treat it, you would not see the kind of recycling that's being done right now. You would not see the mobile waste processing facilities. So regulation has a role to play in prompting innovation that ultimately results in I think, a win for everybody, a healthier environment and a robust industry. If there's lethargy now, it's because gas is below $3 an MCF. And but it is certainly not slowing down in our wet gas area, Pennsylvania, and nor in the Utica and Ohio.
Well, everyone, I want to thank you, first of all, Scott, for your answer and for that question, caller. I want to thank everybody, our participants today, who I think have really added very much to the discussion and debate, Jason Hutt, Scott Perry, and Craig Siegel. I want to thank the Federalist Society for sponsoring this very timely program. And I'll turn it back to you now, Dean.
Well, thank you very much, Joel Burkett. I, of course, want to thank you for organizing the event and moderating it today, and thank all our experts as well. Also, a final thank you for our audience. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For the materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/podcast.